This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to another season of Radio EcoShock. I am your tour guide, Alex Smith. In this week's program, we travel the world. From New Zealand, we'll hash out our disturbed weather with the co-host of The Climate Show, Gareth Renouden. Then it's off to Beijing, straight to China. Greenpeace Asia campaigner Li Yan is our guest. We'll cap that off with Tip of the Iceberg News, my welcome back roundup of world-shaking developments, pointers to great audio, blogs, and articles, and four big trends in the alternative activist scene. Our music artist this week is Deva Premal. Find her at White Swan Records or devapremalmitten.com. All links mentioned in this program are also in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for joining us. Let's get to our guests. Coming back from my annual vacation, I find the world as mad as ever. So much happened, I need help just trying to grasp it all. And who better than Gareth Renouden, co-host of The Climate Show out of New Zealand. Gareth is a truffle specialist. He's a farmer, he's a radio personality, and now he's author of a new sci-fi book titled The Aviator, The Burning World. Gareth Renouden, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. It's a great pleasure.
Well, you know, it's been winter down under where you are, so I hope you've been paying attention to some of the important climate news. What do you think is the top story?
Well, I think without any question, it's definitely the Arctic sea ice. That is top story. It's the top of the world. It's melting, and the records are tumbling up there. So definitely the top story. From my perspective, it's a big and a visible sign of warming. And it has very immediate effects, I think, for the Northern Hemisphere.
Right. Well, I agree. And we're going to do a whole program next week on that meltback in the Arctic. And we've got some super specialists like Jennifer Francis, who talks about how that Arctic sea ice melt could be affecting weather throughout the whole Northern Hemisphere. And we've also got Mark Cerise. He's the expert from the National Snow and Ice Data Center. So he's going to talk to us a bit about those records. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'll absolutely look forward to hearing what Jennifer Francis has to say, because her work has been really at the forefront of tying in the effect of the melt in the Arctic to changing weather patterns in the Northern Hemisphere.
And it has been bizarre here. In the East, there was hardly any winter. Summer started in March for many people, and it burned its way into a huge drought in the Midwest, just now sort of ending with the hurricane. And Britain practically drowned in rain at the same time. Does any of this make the news in New Zealand, or does each hemisphere just stare at their own strange weather?
Oh, I think, yeah, we do hear from the Northern Hemisphere quite a lot. I mean, we're not so insular as to sit out here and just stare at our own navels. But the difficulty with these events is that they get reported as, you know, it's news that there's flooding in Britain, or there's corn dying in the fields in the Midwest of the U.S., or that, you know, that it's been incredibly warm somewhere. Those things get reported, but what you don't get, I think, is sufficient of the big picture. People actually being prepared to say, well, look, these are all signs of what's happening to our climate system. And if you don't get that big picture, I mean, it's just another heat wave. Yeah, okay, so maybe a few records were set, but, you know, that happens all the time. But when you get heat wave and strange weather and sticky weather, which is what Jennifer Francis's work is all about, you see, you have to look at more than just my backyard. You know, you have to be looking across the globe, seeing it all happening and saying, well, hey, look, the big picture here is that there's a lot of weird weather, and that weird weather is along the lines that people have been telling us is likely to happen with climate change, and hey, it's happening now.
Yeah, well, both the IPCC and James Hansen have said that this couldn't be happening without that extra emissions in the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, you know, the attribution of these events to climate change, it is difficult to have a kind of 100% attribution of any given weather event to climate change. But Hansen's recent work makes a very convincing argument for being able to say that all of the heat waves that we're experiencing now are at least in some part a result of the climate change that's taken place in the last 30, 40 years. And I think that what's different, though, is that, and this is where the Arctic comes into it, what's happening up there with the melt of the ice means that when the ice refreezes in winter, an enormous amount of heat has to be lost from the surface of the ocean, and that goes into the atmosphere, and that has an effect. It has to have an effect. It's not something that can just be ignored or is only a small factor. It's actually an enormous factor in the circulation of the Northern Hemisphere. And I think what's taken a lot of people surprise, if you talk to the Arctic ice scientists, they're all surprised that the ice is going as quickly as it seems to be. And I think if you talk to the people who are looking at the effects of that melt on the atmosphere, they're surprised at how the sorts of effects that we're seeing in relation to the Arctic ice melt are happening. I mean, this is all stuff that if you go back to the last IPCC report in 2007, you know, they're talking about, well, you know, maybe by the end of the century we'll be losing the sea ice. And you know, so nobody has really thought terribly hard, I think, anyway, at least until the last few years. What does this mean for our climate system now?
And another strange thing is that it's possible that if you get all that heat released and strange domes building up in the winter, next winter, here in the Northern Hemisphere, that you could drive some colder weather down into Siberia and down into Northern Europe. So it is possible you could go from an extreme of heat waves in the summertime to a really cold winter one winter, and that all could be part of this Arctic melt.
Well, that's absolutely right. And if you look at what's happened in Western Europe in the last few winters, they've had some really quite severe cold spells. The sort of cold spell that might have come along every 20 years, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, now seem to be happening every 2 or 3 years or even more frequently. And that seems to be directly tied to the changes in the atmospheric circulation around the pole. Now, which is in turn related to the accumulation of heat up there, which is melting all the ice. So, you know, it all kind of ties together, but it's like we don't have a roadmap for this because, and this is one of the things that I've been thinking about, and I haven't written about it yet, but I'm sort of working myself up to it. You know, we look at the graphs that you see in IPCC reports, and you look at the graphs of what the sea ice is projected to do over the next 100 years. And what you're looking at generally is a nice smooth line. It's either going up or it's going down, but, you know, it looks like a smooth line. And what that smooth line, those smooth lines usually are the averages of lots of individual model runs. Now, if you look at the data that the individual model runs, they're very noisy. They jump up and down. They don't look like nice smooth lines. They don't look like pretty graphs, if you like. And it's maybe not so easy to see what's going on. But our Earth, the climate system, is only one model. And so what happens in reality is noisy. The lines go up and down a lot. And I think if we really want to get an understanding of what's going to happen to our climate system over the next 20 to 30 years as the Arctic ice disappears, we're going to have to start looking at individual model runs that are related to what we're seeing now. So maybe we've got to go and dig into the model runs that are, you know, maybe they're set 30 or 40 years in the future, but if they have similar ice conditions to now, well, what's happening in those models to the circulation of the atmosphere around the Northern Hemisphere? We're going to have to start diving down into the detail to try and pick out what's happening in the sort of nitty-gritty of where we live, you know?
Well, the fact is we're in uncharted territory. Scientists are just as surprised as the rest of us at what's happening, so I guess we're going to have to watch and wait to a certain degree. And, you know, another underreported story that just fascinates me is the serial drowning of major cities in Asia by extreme precipitation events. We had one in the Philippines in the Manila this summer. They suffered a terrible flood. And then Beijing, China, got 6 months of rain in 24 hours. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, I think there's a New Zealand scientist called Kevin Trenberth, who's really a very prominent climate scientist working at NCAR, in the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. And Kevin is one of the world's leading climate scientists. And the way that he puts it is that, you know, we've had warming over the last 30 to 40 years, and a warmer atmosphere holds more water. And so you've got more water available for precipitation. But what you're seeing in the tropical areas particularly is you're seeing very high sea surface temperatures. So you're getting a lot of water being evaporated off the surface of the ocean. The atmosphere moves over the land, and so you get very intense rainfall. And, I mean, that's one of the most robust predictions of the climate models have made in the last 20 or 30 years, that associated with warming, you're going to see more intense rainfall. And you can actually see it in the figures. The IPCC's report on extremes of weather, which came out late last year or earlier this year, I can't remember, the SREX, that suggested that, you know, we could see signs of climate change and warming in extreme rainfall. But yes, you're right. We're seeing these incredible deluges, and it's not just in tropical regions. Europe has had some astonishingly heavy rain. Last autumn in Europe, there were some incredible rainstorms in Italy, which I'd actually been fortunate enough to be on holiday in the Cinque Terre, which are the very beautiful villages on the coast of the Mediterranean in Liguria. And a couple of weeks later, I was back in New Zealand watching TV and seeing these beautiful villages with huge torrents streaming down their main streets. I think they'd had 200 or 300% of their previous record rainfall in the hills behind these towns. So it is shocking, and it's happening everywhere. But if you know, individual events make news, but unless you have that big picture being presented, you know, it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I'd like to see a big map that where these things just pop up and you could watch it on YouTube, you know. I mean, the African country of Niger just had a crippling drought, and then they had an absolute deluge. One region, this was about a month ago, they got 6 months of rainfall in 24 hours. Who hears about it? Nobody. So I'd love to see that map. Well, on another topic, I've just been going through a study that shows humans tend to be pessimistic about other people, but quite optimistic about themselves and their own chances. And so we may worry about an unstable climate, but we think, well, it won't really affect me that much. And I'm wondering if that's one reason why developed countries refuse to even plan for things like heavy rainstorms or rising seas. Do you see any signs we're getting ready for what is coming?
I don't think we're getting ready for what I think is coming, because what I think is coming is, you know, going to be a real test for our civilization. There are signs, and it varies a lot from country to country and from state to state and from region to region. I mean, there are, you know, different countries are doing different things. In New Zealand, we have begun to take account of sea level rise for coastal development. Now, I might argue that the numbers that they're using do not account for the real potential sea level rise over the next 100 years. But, you know, processes are being put in place. And it's not hard for, you know, if you think there are damaging floods are going to be a more frequent occurrence, or heavy rainfall is going to be a more frequent occurrence, or that the intensity of that rainfall is going to be higher than it's been in the past, then when you put a new subdivision in, maybe you'll make your drainage a bit bigger. So I think those sorts of kind of under the radar, not very high profile stuff is happening. It isn't happening everywhere. You know, we're not all like those American legislators that try to stop mentions of sea level rise going into their planning documents. So, I mean, at that sort of level, I think things are happening. But I don't think that there's, come back to this thing about the big picture. I don't think anyone's really taking account of the big picture and thinking, you know, well, maybe what we're doing is wrong. Maybe here in New Zealand, for instance, the government thinks that it's, you know, one of the routes to economic development for New Zealand is by mining more coal and by drilling for more oil. And in one sense, yeah, we've got some coal and we've probably got some oil. So, yes, we probably could make quite a lot of money, actually, because, you know, oil's running out and coal's not exactly falling out of the sky. So, yeah, maybe we could make a bit of money. But on the other hand, there's a huge liability in doing that, because if we put all of our money now into developing that coal and that oil, then at the point where the world realizes, and I mean the world by the international community, realizes that they are going to have to take this problem seriously, then suddenly what's being written into the books as an asset suddenly becomes a major liability. And you've screwed your economy by pushing it in one direction now because it seems sensible, and then the paradigm shift comes, and I mean, I've got to hope and pray that that paradigm shift happens sooner rather than later, and suddenly all of this stuff which was economically wonderful becomes economically stupid.
Well, I've got to introduce you to our Prime Minister, because we've got him pushing the tar sands like a salesman at a used car lot. This is Radio Eco Shock. From the Waipara Valley of New Zealand, we are talking with Gareth Renouden, co-host of The Climate Show. Gareth, I've been a fan of that program. It's amazing the way you and radio broadcaster Glenn Williams managed to do both video and audio, occasionally with some computer graphics thrown in there. What's happening with The Climate Show at the moment?
Well, as you may have known, we've mentioned it a couple of times in the sort of last couple of shows. Glenn has made a move to the UK. So he and his partner have gone over to London, and they're setting up home in London. And I understand from Glenn's tweets recently that their sort of shipping container of their gear from Auckland has arrived in London. So I'm very much hoping Glenn's going to be setting up his own little broadcasting studio in his home in London. And The Climate Show will get underway again fairly soon. We're going to have a bit of technological experimentation, because what was working over the network of New Zealand and suddenly going to have to be thoroughly global. And if regular viewers or listeners to The Climate Show will know that the technology challenge of using Skype over sort of sometimes ropey internet connections can be quite large, but we're going to give it a go. It'll be Glenn having breakfast and me having dinner, and John Cook will all be doing something else. But The Climate Show will be coming back.
And where can people find your past programs?
There are two places. One is the Climate Show website. Just Google The Climate Show, and that will get you the Climate Show website. And the other is at Hot Topic, which is my blog in New Zealand, hot-topic.co.nz. And there's a Climate Show category in the just above the logo at the top of the blog there.
All right. Well, Gareth Renouden, you've just released your first science fiction book. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Aviator. I nicked an idea from a famous old writer called Jonathan Swift, who listeners may have heard of, because he wrote a book called Gulliver's Travels. And I've been thinking for some years, that, you know, it's one thing for you and I, Alex, to talk about climate change and the impacts and what's happening in the news and there's everything else. And that informs a certain sort of person. It provides a certain context, information that people can use in their day-to-day lives. But there is another and equally powerful, probably perhaps even more powerful way of making people think about that issues, and that's by telling stories. And what I wanted to do is to tell a story about the world that we're heading for without, I didn't want to scare people, but I wanted people to realize that the settings that we're on are taking us to a place which is, yeah, pretty unreal, really. And so what I wanted to do is to create a world, which I've called the Burning World, and I wanted to put into it a means of getting around that world to explore what climate change has done and what our policies and ideas and communities, how they might be sort of coping in the future. One of the things that people often don't realize about Gulliver's Travels, they think that it's a kid's book, because it's been retold for children over many, many hundreds of years. But in fact, when Swift wrote it, it was a satire of the sort of court and politics and ideas of the time. And so I wanted my book to be, you know, gently satirical, if you like, about some of the ways that we think about things. So my hero is called Lemuel, which is what Gulliver's Christian name was. And Lemmy and his girlfriend Kate basically fly around this climate-changed world, and they visit the new polar cities in the Canadian archipelago. They're called Lovelock and Bloom. And they cross a melting Greenland. They visit the Northern Lights, which are actually the methane fires north of Siberia. And then they go on and they meet communities. There's the rock god Evangelist. There's the last community of climate deniers. There's the libertarians in their big bubble. So, yeah, basically, it's a sort of a, I've been calling it a comedy adventure satire.
The ultimate climate road trip, perhaps.
Something like that, yes. And it's in its very early days at the moment. It's sort of creeping out. It's available on Amazon and Smashwords, and will be available on most of the major ebook retailers in the very near future. And I'm just putting together, actually, I stopped when you rang. I was putting together the print version, which will be available sometime in September. And, then I've got to start writing the book two. Yeah, everybody who's read it seems to want to know what happens next. So I've got a bounden duty, I suppose.
So keep your eye out for The Aviator. And I want to say, too, that from what I've seen, islands in the sea like the UK and New Zealand may be better protected from extreme climate change than the great continents or even Australia. I heard New Zealand agreed to take some climate refugees, namely people from low-lying reef countries in the South Pacific. Is that correct?
It's not. I mean, I think Al Gore said that we'd agreed to take lots of climate refugees from sinking Pacific islands. We actually have the relationship that we have with the Pacific Islands is a bit more complex than that. I think there are some Pacific islands where the population of islanders in New Zealand is greater than that left on the original islands now anyway. But that's so far been mainly economic in terms of the migration. But yeah, I mean, I think as one of the richer countries in the region and one of the larger countries in the region, I think it's pretty inevitable that we're going to end up providing a refuge for those Pacific Islanders who find themselves threatened by rising sea levels. I will say that New Zealand is probably going to be a good place to ride out climate change, because we are surrounded by a big and relatively cool ocean, which will act as a kind of air conditioner for us. But, you know, I take that as a small compensation, because, you know, in reality, the rest of the world is going to get hammered, and we will not be immune down here. We've had some pretty weird weather too. I mean, we get months. This winter has had a couple of really sharp cold spells with amazing frosts for our valley, almost unheard of, certainly not measured in the last 20 or 30 years. And then we've had 3 weeks of extremely wet weather, and now it's the equivalent of the end of February down here, and I'm looking outside, the air temperature's about 15, 16 degrees Celsius. The lawn was mowed for the first time on Sunday, and that probably means once I've started, I have to continue. So it's almost as though, we're almost feels like early summer out there. So it's the variability is biting everywhere, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be hard for people who are raising food, as you are. How did you become a journalist and a communicator?
Oh, long time ago. I left university and sort of fell into a job in publishing and ended up being a writer and then a magazine editor and then a magazine publisher. And almost everything I've done, if I haven't been writing, I've usually felt that I ought to be. So, yeah, writing, I think, is one of the things that it's, you know, you talk to a lot of writers, so they just, you can't stop doing it. You have to find something to write about. And I was interested in climate change a long time ago, actually, while I was at school and going to university. I can remember reading books about how the climate system worked. It's not what I studied at university, but I've always been interested in weather and climate. And I sort of followed the development of the issue in the late 80s and early 90s. In fact, in my wife and I were living in London in the early 90s. We bought a house in a suburb called Teddington, and I actually planted a peach tree because I thought that, in 15 or 20 years' time, the peaches would do really well, which is not something you'd often say in London. One day I'll go back to that house and see if that peach tree is producing peaches.
Gareth, we are running out of time. Is there something else you'd like to tell our listeners as we wrap up?
Well, I'd keep watching the north, really. A friend in the UK have asked me, how will we know when climate change is going to get really bad? And my answer has been pretty consistently since 2007, just watch what's happening in the Arctic, because that's where climate change is happening writ large. And what's happened up there this year just demonstrates that climate change is not a theoretical possibility for all of our futures. Climate change is real, and it's here, and it's happening now.
Well, give us a couple of your websites just to help people out.
Okay, so you can follow what I'm up to at hot-topic.co.nz, and the climate show is at theclimateshow.com. And if anyone wants to follow up on The Aviator, you can just search for The Aviator at Amazon, or it's on amazon.com and .uk and so on. And The Aviator has its own website, which is burningworldbooks at WordPress. So it should be easy to find.
From New Zealand, thanks so much, Gareth Renaten.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
There's no way to do anything but skim over some world-shattering news, along with developments in the alternative movement. And so, it's time for Tip of the Iceberg News. The macroeconomy is sinking. The United States is set for a leveraged buyout, Bain Capital style. That's where you raid a company, or a country, with a few million in campaign donations, maybe load up the victim with unrepayable debt, while paying out big-time fees that heads for a tax-free trip to the Cayman Islands. Get the details from one of the best pieces of American journalism in a generation, Matt Taibbi's article, Greed and Debt, The True Story of Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. It's in the online version of Rolling Stone magazine. In Europe, Spain is going down. So far, about 17% of all the money in Spanish banks has left the country. One bank has already been nationalized. The others bought billions in Spanish government debt with bailout money poured in by the European Union. Spain makes Greece look tiny in comparison. Spain's collapsed economy and real estate is a sinkhole, threatening to drag down the even larger magnificent Ponzi debt scheme of Italy. And then it's a sleigh ride all the way down for the European Union. China is holding a big garage sale and still can't get rid of its overstocked warehouses. People are being laid off there, my friends, and they're calling for another bailout. It seems their overseas customers are broke. In the U.S., helicopter Ben Bernanke has already offered bailout number three, billions more dollars, we don't know how much, out off the government printing presses and into the hidden accounts of bankers and hedge funds. You know it's bad when the bailouts come. Don't sit up late waiting for your check. Despite all that, I don't expect a big crash really soon. Remember, even after the $50 billion Ponzi fraud by Bernie Madoff was exposed and documented, it took another 8 years for the man to fall. See the documentary film Chasing Bernie Madoff with whistleblower Harry Markopoulos. You'll see how the system never works to protect you. You hear rumors about China, the coal plant a week meme, and big storms. When we come back, we'll go to Beijing with Greenpeace campaign leader Li Yan. That's followed by more Tip of the Iceberg news and a peek at upcoming programs. Stay tuned with Radio EcoShock.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Direct from Beijing, China, we have Li Yan, head of the Climate and Energy Campaign in East Asia for Greenpeace. Li Yan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
Well, please help us understand the climate change and energy problem from the Asian perspective. To begin, is China now the largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions, and what are the latest estimates?
I'm afraid China is the largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions. It's the top one already, probably starting from 2009 or even earlier, depending on different statistics source. But however, right now, annually, carbon dioxide emission from China totally is around 9 billion tons of carbon dioxide per year. And if you calculate the per capita emission, which is so how much an average Chinese person is emitting, then it's around, I think it's beyond 7 tons of carbon dioxide. Just to give it a bit more perspective, right now, by per capita emission, China is somewhere between Italy and France. So it's already higher than Italy, but not as high as the most developed OECD countries yet.
Well, that's very helpful. I want to ask you, how much of that comes from coal?
Coal is the biggest single source of carbon dioxide from China. It's over half of the emission come directly from coal. Because if you're looking at China as a country and also a developing country, majority of its emissions still is generated by energy and by its energy practice. Like people need electricity and heating and also on transport. And then coal is supplying 70%, nearly 70% of that energy, that all energy China is demanding. So actually coal is behind the strong GDP growth in the recent decade, and that's also making coal the biggest corporate in terms of carbon dioxide emission. At the same time, actually it's also one of the biggest single source of local environmental degradation. Air pollution, water usage, land degradation, and health impacts. So if we have to talk about climate change and environmental problem in China, there's no way to get around coal.
North American news media often reports one new coal plant a week opens in China. Is that really true? And how much new coal power is coming on stream?
That's a very famous quote. I think that quote is from, again, 2009-08. Looking back now, it's actually not a week. Well, it's a famous journalist, I think, in Guardian, calculated all the coal power plants in China in that year, and then find out that by average, it's around 10 days that a new coal plant would be put online and start generating. Right now, I think the speed of new coal in China is not that high. We're at 2012, and then around 2008 and 2009, there was a high peak of coal growth. So it's not a week or 2 weeks, but it's still growing very fast.
I was just going to ask whether the new plants that are being built, it's very important whether they're efficient or inefficient, like how much coal they have to burn to produce a certain amount of power.
Yeah, exactly. It's fair that we are observing that the government, especially central government, is trying to push through regulatory changes to require more efficient coal power plants on new builds. So there has been a large initiative in the last 5-6 years of shutting down the least efficient or the most polluting smaller plants, small boilers across the country. And then at the same time, the new build must be as efficient as possible. So looking from these technology perspective, the new power plants getting online, that's quite a difference between U.S. and China. That on the Chinese side, new plants are generally more efficient. Like right now, they're required that the ultra-supercritical power plants is required in most of the larger new projects. But there are still inefficient plants running. I think that's one of the must-do for the Chinese government to still keeping its shutting down least efficient boilers. And back in 2008-09, it was all the plants that are below 20 megawatts must be, it's the most dirty part, so it needs to be shut down. And right now, they're also moving the benchmark higher. So on that, the technology is upgrading. I think in general, right now, on average, to generate one kilowatt hour of electricity in China, the power plants on average are burning 320 or 330 grams of coal standard. And then that figure still has a bit, has a lot of space to improve, actually.
Okay. Now, is China's increased energy use a result of a growing wealthy or middle class, or is it part of the mass movement to cities that is happening pretty well all over the world, or what would you say?
The huge urbanization trend happening in China is pretty unprecedented all across the world. I remember when I was still studying in college just many years ago, we were still in news. We were described as farmer-dominated country. So 70% and 60% of the population still lives in rural area. But right now, the country is hitting a historical turning point that the population divided into urban population and rural population at about the same. And then there's also projection that over 100 million or even more people are still moving into city in the next couple of years. This is a very profound social and economic change. And yes, it is driving energy demands much faster than the last decades. At the same time, when people move to city, they want better lifestyle. They want better life. They want more comfortability with the family. So there is energy use growth driven by that as well. But I think one thing I want to point out is if we look at the data, the statistic data of energy, it's actually industry are the biggest energy user, electricity user in China, especially the heavy industry, like the steel, cement, glass, and the construction, all the construction-related industries. These industries are driven by two biggest factors. One is like we were talking about the growing demands in cities like real estate and infrastructure. But the other part is actually export driven. It's being manufactured and it's being exported to all over the world, to other countries. So these heavy industry driven and very energy intensive development mode is one unique mark of China's energy footprint, I think. And to tackle the energy and carbon dioxide problem, still you have to, the government still need to work from this biggest chunk of energy requirements.
Can you describe some climate change impacts on China?
In Greenpeace, we have been traveling, witnessing what climate change really means to China in the last 6 years. China is, this is something people, especially out of China, tend to neglect or tend to forget that actually China is one of the biggest victims of climate change. So it has a vast types of different natural disasters, and because of climate change, these natural disasters, these extreme weather events are getting worse and worse. We're seeing floods, typhoon, droughts, and heat waves hitting the population much worse in the last decades than previously. And then the worst thing is actually it's hitting the poor community the hardest. And at some places, it might even be eaten up the economic development in the poor regions or even the poverty alleviation efforts with those communities. And a very obvious proof of climate impacts in China, as we have seen by ourselves, is the melting of the glaciers and tundras up on the Tibetan Plateau. That's being called at the Water Tower for Asia. Multiple major rivers for Eastern and Southern Asia actually originated from Tibet and has been running down the Himalaya regions and all the way to feed millions of population downstream. And it's really, really, really worrying to see those glaciers melting at a very fast speed, unseen speed. This would deplete this water reserve, solid water reserve, in 3 or 4 decades' time. Right now, it doesn't seem like a big deal, but in 3 or 4 decades' time, this prospect of major rivers running out of water is really, really worrying, and it will have major impact on people, on the millions of people. That's still, I think, one challenge we're facing right now is people still tend to distant those extreme weathers and disasters happening from place that they can see and feel that this is nothing related to their lives. And most recently, I think one thing is pretty iconic in terms of changing people's mind and making them think, well, this is something happening, something is wrong with the climate. And just last month, there was a huge rainstorm hitting Beijing. It's only 8 hours, I think 7 or 8 hours of a heavy rain. But the result is, it's astonishing. It's actually killed 70 people in the biggest city and most populated, most advanced city in China. Putting a huge question mark of, first of all, why is that happening? Why is this big rainstorm happening? And what's the science proof behind it? And second, are we ready for those extreme disasters? In the drought area, are we ready for more frequent flood and rainstorms? And that's actually the big question mark climate change is posing to China.
How does the state-run media discuss the climate change issue?
I think this is again a difference that I'm observing happening in China with other countries. In China, there is a pretty high level recognition of climate change as a science reality, and then it is a big issue. It is of a political priority that the country must tackle. There is also people questioning: is climate change true? Is the science all real? Is there any other theory? That's again naturally also happening, but in mass media in China, the mainstream lines about climate change is it is proved science and it is something we need to be serious about. So actually state-run media, just from our contacts in the last years, has been actually pretty engaged in talking about climate change and its solution. I think the missing part to make it even more progressive is the source of climate change, that the media is talking about weather changes, is talking about we need carbon emission cuts, but not too many of them are directly linking the emission and weather disasters back to coal. And that we see is a pretty big problem to be solved. And there has to be a very strong link between the source and the reason, beginning of the change, climate change consequences of it and solution of it. But generally, I think it's much better of our media reporting climate change in a much better atmosphere than that in North America.
We get weather reports, but very seldom do they mention that climate change could be part of it. And then we get a lot of car advertising or big oil companies advertising right after it. So you can see that the commercial stations depend on oil revenues and car revenues to make money. And so they're not telling us very much.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Li Yan from Greenpeace in Beijing. I know China's becoming a world leader in alternative energy as well. Can you tell us about that?
China is leading in wind energy already. This is also a kind of a legend kind of thing, because in 2005, when Greenpeace started working on wind energy in China, it's still like a high-tech geeky new trend, and it's very, very small, just in one or two provinces having pilot projects, but just 6 years away from the beginning of the wind power development. Right now China already has over 60 gigawatt of wind turbines installed, and it's also the biggest manufacturer in the world providing the wind equipment, wind turbine equipment. That's a result of a doubling development in several years in a row. And it's actually a very encouraging sign. At the same time, in solar power generation, like solar panels, that's something I think you can see a mixed story, that on one hand, China is the biggest manufacturer. It's producing all the solar panels, and majority of them transporting overseas, and especially to European market and also to North America market. And you probably also noticed these huge export has been causing also trade disputes. But at the same time, being a country of vast solar potential, installation in China, really using the solar panels in China, is still pretty minimum, very, very small. 5% of the total manufactured solar panels can be used in domestic market, and it's just untapped yet. So yes, China is leading in alternative energy on many perspectives, but I think China has a way larger potential to move forward on this direction. And if you consider the urgency of the problems that we're facing, climate change and coal pollution, and also many places are being locked in the very fossil fuel driven development model, and have less choice, less options for alternative development model, then I think the country still need to speed up. I have actually strong confidence that China can be a superpower in renewable energy in the world, and there's also not a lot to learn from both U.S. and Europe. Like the solar panel practice in U.S. is I think pretty encouraging. So I'll be really, really inspired if countries, these leading countries, can really treat alternative energy as a new competitiveness advantage and have a green race amongst themselves. And that would be really ideal for the world.
Li-Yan, as we finish up, could you describe some Greenpeace activities in China?
Greenpeace is established we basically started from Hong Kong in 1997, and in 2001, we opened our Beijing office. And right now, we have five major environmental campaigns, and the priority one is this one that we are talking about, the climate and energy work, really focusing on pushing forward the climate change agenda in China, in the biggest emitter and victim of the world, and tackling its heavy coal reliant energy mix. And we also have also very important other campaigns on pollution, tackling water pollution and the chemical pollution in China, which is also burning issue for the public. And also the third campaign is on food and agriculture. This is with the aim to pursue a sustainable, healthy agriculture and food instead of chemical and fertilizer intensive and genetic modified pathway. And we're also working on forest protection, both protecting local forest and in southern part of China, as well as joining hands with our colleagues across the world to protect the most important hotspot in Amazon, in Indonesia, in Congo forest. And then there's a new campaign opening on ocean protection. That's the long-standing campaign of protecting like whales and other biodiversity in the oceans and against overfishing practice. So all in all, Greenpeace is already a very solid and organization, one of the leading international NGOs in China, and we have over 60 staff here. And then sometimes the most frequent question I was asked is, so are you guys still able to run campaigns in China, and how can you still run campaigns in China? I think the fact that we have 60 staff working on five really important and prosperous campaigns here is already a proof that that there's a lot of space to really pursue environmental protection in this country.
Well, yes, in the long term, a healthy environment is for the benefit of all the people and the government, so it's good the work that you're doing. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from Beijing was Li-Yan, head of the Climate and Energy Campaign for Greenpeace in East Asia. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
And now more Tip of the Iceberg News. All right, let's move on to climate news. You've heard about the big news in the melting Arctic, and the runner-up is the giant drought this year in America. When the Mississippi dries up so the barges can't make it up the river, you know we're in trouble. Cattlemen sold off their beef throughout the southern U.S. as feed prices soared. You can expect cheap meat now. Stick it in the freezer, because next year is going to make you want to become a vegetarian as prices skyrocket. Do it. Become a vegetarian. It's good for you and good for the planet. America is the world's grocery store for the overpopulated poor overseas. Even though food prices are already rising, the Obama administration has not changed the policy of diverting huge amounts of corn into ethanol production. We'll burn up some family's dinner just getting to the corner store for a soda. Get ready to grow your own, or at least make friends with farmers. Fukushima. Since nobody's covering it, I have to give you a little bit of Fukushima news. Hey, Fukushima, it's so yesterday. Except this Japanese triple meltdown just keeps ticking along like a slow-motion atomic bomb. The Japanese government announces they will study the health impacts. That's a great idea, starting only 18 months too late. The government is also going to allow foreign experts to offer ideas. They are negotiating with the International Atomic Energy Agency. The IAEA is the body responsible for pushing and selling and promoting nuclear power around the world, so they should be pretty unreliable, but it's better than just relying on TEPCO and the government in Tokyo. In a surreal move, various government agencies are already planning an alleged cleanup of the Fukushima region, even though radioactive cesium has a half-life of 30 years. The other elements released in the accident, up to and including both uranium and plutonium, last hundreds of thousands of years, and it's scattered all over the place. What are they going to do? Scrape up all the soil, put it in big piles, and move that all around Japan, maybe burn it up, put it into the atmosphere? It's a crazy plan. And we're already seeing artists' conceptions of green spaces and new industrial areas in the radioactive hot zones. The farmers say they're going back to growing food there next year. It's a pathetic, terrible lie for Japan.
So they're carrying a huge burden on an aging, shrinking population. It's not a great situation, that's for sure.
Well, let alone the number of malignancies and diseases that are going to accrue from this accident. I mean, we know that the data from Chernobyl shows that within the first 25 years, up to 1 million people have died. And we're going to talk about the next 300 years or 600 years as long as cesium remains radioactive. But there are other elements that remain radioactive for hundreds, thousands, if not millions of years. And they're similarly in the mix, as is the cesium. And so if you, and you have said yourself, Arnie Gunderson, that you think the Fukushima releases of radiation were 2.5 to 3 times greater than those from Chernobyl. So, and the Japanese population is much more densely situated than people living around Chernobyl. So if you multiply 1 million in the first 25 years by 2.5 or 3 from your data, you could end up with a figure like 3 million people dying in the first 25 years in Japan.
According to nuclear expert Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds.com, the reactor cores are likely no longer molten. Just brilliant hot blobs that run away nobody knows where. The three reactor buildings are still unapproachable without risking lives. They are still building up explosive hydrogen daily and require nitrogen to be pumped in to avoid more explosions, an earthquake, or any technical problem with the pumps, the jerry-rigged system of pipes, or the electricity supply, or a human error could still lead to more radioactive explosions. TEPCO, the operator, has attempted to strengthen the Reactor 4 fuel pool building, also wrecked in the explosions. All that fuel, from 40 years of operation plus the hot fuel bundle just removed before the accident, is still balanced dangerously, precariously, several stories above the ground. Another major earthquake could drop all that fuel, likely poisoning central Japan, including Tokyo, and likely the whole northern hemisphere. They've had plenty of earthquakes since. It hasn't hit them quite right. The government is moving far too slowly to get the fuel out. Radioactive water is still leaking all over the site, including into the turbine halls. We don't know how much has reached the water table or the Pacific Ocean. The government either doesn't know, doesn't want to know, or doesn't want you to know. Other than that, Fukushima is doing fine. You must listen to a great radio podcast with anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott interviewing Arnie Gunderson in the free August 20th podcast of If You Love This Planet. Download it from iTunes or find a link in my show blog at ecoshock.info.
I'm going to send you four before, because four was the four that stood at the door.
I have to report four trends I'm seeing in the alternative and activist scene. A rising tide of people realize climate change, energy depletion, and economic collapse are inevitable. Sooner or later, it is happening. Trend 1. There is a chorus of famous writers, bloggers, and scientists who are publicly mourning the passing of the Holocene Age and our descent into the Anthropocene, the age brought about by humankind. Many of our favorite plants and animals will not survive the change. We don't know if we will. Everything will shift underneath us like a climate quake. Author Chris Hedges, returning as I am from a summer getaway in nature, has a touching piece titled Life is Sacred. Find it at the Truth Dig blog at Rolling Stone magazine website, Truth Dig, or find a link in my blog at ecoshock.info. Hedges knows we are already on the path towards ecological destruction, at least in human terms. Like me, he fears for the times of his children. Trend 2, as I've covered in past Radio EcoShock shows with guests like Paul Kingsnorth, there is an even louder chorus calling for a quick downfall of the industrial system. You should listen to Derek Jensen on that, perhaps. One of my listeners wrote in an email, many believe human extinction is on its way. We need to consider a hospice society, making the way out less painful, perhaps even more joyful. There is still joy to harvest, he writes. Carolyn Baker of Speaking Truth to Power has written a great article on prepper fatigue. Lots of commentators on blogs like Zero Hedge are becoming jaded about any predictions of a financial collapse. The whole mad Ponzi scheme, which Max Kaiser calls the casino gulag, just keeps on dancing in midair until, like Bernie Madoff, some outside force of events intervenes and the music stops.
Get ready for Survivor! Musical chairs!
I'm so excited!
Trend 3. Some fairly famous figures and movement leaders are bailing out. It's not just that people are burned out hitting their heads against that immovable wall of human insanity. They're going quiet, moving to rural areas in some cases, dropping their blogs and writings, or just hanging out in cities. It's like an Atlas Shrugged situation, abandoned, but not by the industrialists. They're still in there grabbing the money, although they're becoming an extinct breed supplanted by corporate raiders. But by those people who are seeking an alternative, they are leaving, and it's not a good sign. Michael C. Rupert was the subject of the movie Collapse. Last April, he left the online community he helped found at CollapseNet.com. That's still running. You should check it out. Now he's gone to Colorado with his dog. Mike hasn't exactly gone silent. He still has his popular radio program on PRN on Sunday evenings, but he's out of here. I know others. It's not looking good when they go quiet. Trend 4, related to all of the above perhaps, many people are now seeking out spiritual practices as a way to cope with the unbearable weight of knowing. Rupert is trying a mix of American Indian shamanism and Alcoholics Anonymous. Two leaders from the Transition USA movement, Michael Brownlee and Lynette Marie Hanthorne, are proposing deep transition. They are seeking ways to digest our lurch into mass suicide. Is it really a new beginning, perhaps? A hard evolution into a type of humanity that can live in nature. Find a link to that conversation on the Lifeboat Hour radio program in my blog, or Google the Lifeboat Hour and download the September 2nd program, hosted by Carolyn Baker. I'm worried a bit. In our distress, some people will turn away from science and activism toward ancient superstitions that took us centuries to overcome. Is it time to really look inward rather than outward? There's a lot to talk about here, and we will, in the coming season of Radio EcoShock. In our next Radio EcoShock show, we will hear three top scientists on the record meltdown of Arctic sea ice. One guest will be Jennifer Francis, the Rutgers University atmospheric scientist, who leads observations on the way sea ice melt is changing our climate throughout the Northern Hemisphere. It's some of the most urgent science on the block with your life in the balance. We'll also hear from Dr. Cecilia Bitz, helping us understand how the Arctic climate works and why it matters so much. Plus, Mark Cerise, the director of the U.S. National Snow and Ice Data Center, explaining the satellite shots, explaining the new record low levels of ice. It's the biggest story in many thousand years. We've not made a larger change on the Earth than this. After that, you get a surprise special on the unbelievable tipping point developing as we air condition the planet. followed by a whole program on developments in what I see as our only response so far, the Transition Town Movement. Personally, I spent a month at our country village retreat. We added more insulation, 120 watts of solar power, a handy garden shed, and a large garden fence 6 feet high to keep the deer out and the other pests. My most important time was spent getting to know more of my neighbors there. Small communities are still functioning, with people helping people. I like it, and I hope to move there. It's not much, but that's about all I can do at this point, other than making radio shows for you. I'm back in the city, diving through the news, reports, and science, and truly helpful tips from listeners like you. You can write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Gear up for another nail-biting season with Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. As always, I thank you for listening and caring about your world.